cause everybody asked me where you at. I tried to channel you in hopes that I could spare you back. But this like every intersection, we just missed each other. You got your fans waiting, tell me you ain't 6 feet under. And tell me that you coming back and you just took a break. Maybe I blamed you for everything that was my mistake.
Welcome back. We're actually here again so soon. We haven't taken a million year hiatus. Because we're so excited to talk about the Starfish book today, number 32, The Separation. We were just talking a little bit about how horrifying this book is. You may have seen, if you look at Animorphs Things on Tumblr, the text post that Diana was just talking about with the laughing at the Starfish book or Starfish cover, that it's like kind of silly. And then really, though, there's a whole list of horrifying things that happen in this book that show us that Animorphs is really more than its silly covers and 1990s bad CGI on the Nickelodeon TV show. Animorphs is not to be trifled with. And that is, this book is a really good example of something that is very funny and hijinksy in a way. And it does take moments of hijinks and comedy, but really underneath it is something deeply upsetting.
Yeah, I can't imagine, honestly, in hindsight, I can't imagine my mom, like, wanting me to read this.
Oh, that's a good point. I've never thought about that.
I mean, she never made any, like, overtures to, like, what I was reading when I was a kid. If she had actually bothered to read what I was reading, probably a lot of the time she would have been like, actually, no, you're not going to read the rest of the series, which may have been a good choice, considering that everything is a downhill slide into darkness and despair from here on out.
It really is.
Or from the get-go, as we have seen.
It is. Well, and I think Rachel serves very much as sort of a flag in the wind, I guess, for that. Or, like, her descent into darkness and despair very much mirrors, or maybe even leads the march.
she's the vanguard for...
Thank you, that's the word I'm looking for. Thank you for having a bigger vocabulary than me. Before we get into all of the specific nitty-gritty of this book, we will first outline to you, of course, what happens in it. So we're in a Rachel narration, and the events happen very quickly. They're on a field trip at the beach, and Rachel drops an earring. And so it's like an earring that her dad gave her, and it's really special to her. So she morphs a starfish in order to get it back out of, like, a little tidal pool.
Yeah, it's in, like, a rock crevice where, you know, humans can't get to, but starfish could.
Exactly.
And they've got lots of hands. Very helpful.
Very helpful. So she morphs a starfish and then, unfortunately, is bisected by a passing...
Horrible bratty children.
That's the real lesson here.
Control your kids. Don't let them abuse animals. God.
Exactly. This would not have happened if that little punk hadn't been running on the beach. She morphs out of starfish because she's like, crap, I'm in half, so I need to become a human again. But she did not have the biological know-how that Cassie has, and that hopefully we as readers, as adults, have, or rereaders of this book, since we already know what happens, that starfish can, in fact, regenerate. And so the half of herself as a starfish that she left on the beach regenerated and, or maybe didn't regenerate, regardless, still had the capacity to morph back into human. And so Rachel herself was bisected into the two polar opposites of her personality to, like, the extreme. K.A. fools us a little bit, again, unless you're rereading, because the first, like, four or five chapters, she doesn't tell you about the narration switch, and you think it's Rachel the whole time, but Rachel with Tobias is really ruthless, and as a bird, like, eats a fish that's still alive for, like, no reason, just that she wants to kill. And then the other Rachel is with Cassie at the mall, and is really airheaded. Maybe. And preppy and, like, worried also. Part of what's interesting about this book and part of what's horrifying about this book is seeing these traits manifested in these two people and knowing that they are both part of who Rachel is as a person. And there's, and it's not a good situation for anyone. And both characters are unreliable in crisis situations and in mission situations, because there is a mission floating along in the background. There is a new technology that the Yurks are developing called the anti-morphing ray. And the idea is that, like, if they use it, it can zap somebody out of a morph. And the Animorphs, obviously, this would be horrible for them. And their, you know, identity is humans and not Andalites. And so there are several missions, I think two missions in the book, in trying to seize the anti-morphing ray while it's being moved. And ultimately they fail both times, but that's really not the point. The point is to demonstrate that both Rachels, both parts of Rachel, independently of one another, are just, like, catastrophic to have around.
Yeah, it's noted that mean Rachel, scary Rachel, the warrior side of Rachel, cannot make any kind of, like, long-term plans. She just, like, barrels in, wants to tear shit up, which she, you know, of course she perceives to be good because she's unreliable. It's a great case of unreliable narrators. Two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, nice Rachel, like, doesn't have any initiative, is scared. She encounters a mean girl at the mall and cries, and that's what tips Cassie off to, like, something is wrong, because Rachel just cried instead of, like, cracking this girl's skull.
Yeah. Well, and then mean Rachel encounters the same girl in Williams-Sonoma and then pins her to the wall and nearly stabs her with a knife. So,
yes, many knives are involved in that scene.
It's horrible. That's like this, I mean, the example that Diana gave of one of the horrible things from that text post is the part where Rachel rips off her own arm, or her arm is ripped off and she uses her grizzly bear arm to beat somebody with it.
It's like, and she's fighting a horcrugeur and, like, you know, she loses a limb, and generally that's like a game changer, right? You lose a limb, you gotta go and, like, remorph, quick! Otherwise, you're going to die. And instead, yeah, she picks the severed arm up and wails on the horcrugeur with it. And, I mean, like, on the surface, it's like a lot of this is funny because it's, like, so outrageous. You know, Rachel going at some girl in Williams and Sonoma, like, the cooking store of moms everywhere, and, like, sticking knives into her sweatshirts, like, pin her to a wall. Like, that's wacky. But
oh, no, it's so much more.
It's very chilling to read.
It's a very disturbing portrait of someone. And both of them act they act out their parts without any inhibition. And as the book goes on, they start to second guess themselves a little bit. And that's part of, like, Rachel's process of self-reflection and things like that. And, like, mean Rachel realizes that she needs nice Rachel in order to be able to plan, and that she can't see into the future. It's like a big blind spot. And that, like, terrifies her, that she's just lacking that part of
She doesn't have the skill to back up the strength, basically. And then, of course, nice Rachel is like, you know, I need her too, because I'm paralyzed, like, by fear.
Mm.
Without her, like, I can think ahead, I can, like, see the future, and that's the paralytic agent. Like, it's, which, honestly, yeah, I get paralyzed when I think about the future, too.
Ding, ding, ding! Samesies!
This book, like, all Animorphs books are about identity, and have a very, like, the series has a very strong theme of identity, in varying degrees, and usually, you know, you could certainly make that physical in terms of the fact that they can literally change their forms. And, you know, the one relief is like, oh, you know, you can change into an ant, you can change into a bear, you can change into anything that lives on planet Earth, any alien life that you encounter, you can make yourself that thing. But you always have to come back to yourself. And, like, so that's kind of reassuring that, like, at the end of the day, when you demorph, you're going to be Rachel. But this book just, like, shatters that. Because the thing that's supposed to save her, demorphing out of this starfish, is the thing that kicks everything off. Because suddenly she's confronted, her, you know, her personality confronts itself. Mm-hmm. Her friends are confronted with things that they didn't really want to acknowledge before. And then at the end, she is too. Like, she has to say, both of these things live inside me. Neither of these Rachels were useful. Neither of them were, like, good people. They had all these problems. Like, my friends had to deal with them, and now I have to deal with it too. Like, that's because they're me. And mm-hmm. So it's just like, it's really rough.
Well, that's the thing is we can make a lot of comparisons to other media, and we're going to in a minute. But one of these things, like, as I was reading, I thought about, like, Freaky Friday, where, like, it's two polar opposites who spend their time, and, like, the trajectory of their arc is that they learn to appreciate what the other has that they don't, and vice versa. And, you know, cruising towards the end, you're like, okay, that's kind of what's going on here. My, you know, nice Rachel needs mean Rachel needs nice Rachel. But it's really not that comforting, and it's really not that simple. And exactly what you said, it's actually really, it cracks a lot of things open, not only for Rachel to see, but also everyone. And none of them like dealing with either Rachel. They have to lie to nice Rachel in order to get her to do things. They have to knock out mean Rachel and subdue her to prevent her from doing things. Cassie's role as best friend is not really meaningful to mean Rachel. And then nice Rachel, it's like something different. It's like not, it's really not meaningful in the same way either. And we don't get to see Rachel's reaction to it. It's kind of a dot, dot, dot. And we know from here on out that Rachel is going to be struggling with these two halves of herself that aren't harmonious, that don't really work together to be successful. You know, they do in a functional way, in that Rachel is useful, actual Rachel is useful, but in terms of characteristics and your inner voices, like, they're not two great halves to have. And that's something as well to think about, is that, like, much in the way of Kronk's shoulder angel and shoulder devil, like, these are two voices that Rachel hears in her head at all times, and they're so opposite. With Rachel books, it is always interesting to be privy to what she's thinking, just because her sense of bravado hides a lot of internal vulnerability and doubt and stuff like that that she does have. That is always interesting, seeing it manifest in sort of an in-character way in her own narrations. But knowing that, like, both of these dialogues are going on in her head is sort of like, oh.
Plus, I mean, from the beginning of the series and escalating this point, I would say this book is the turning point. You know, we've seen Jake call on Rachel before for things that nobody else can do. Like with David, most notably.
Uh-huh.
But from here on out, like, you know, that's something that this book forces Jake to acknowledge. It forces Rachel to acknowledge. Like, even once she's back to, like, you know, to herself, even once there's only one normal standard Rachel, like, that's the side of her that the Animorphs are going to need and need and need. And, like, nobody wants to see that in themselves. And nobody wants to do that to their friends.
Another part of what's sad about it is that Rachel questions, if it had been one of the others, would it be this stark? Would there be, if you split Jake in two, or Cassie in two, or Axe, or Tobias? Weirdly enough, Marco's the only one she doesn't, like, question about.
It's because Marco is only ever himself.
That's true. You can't. You would just have
what
two Marcos.
What you see is what you get. That's not entirely true, but it's the most true out of any of them, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And she sort of realizes that, yes, a lot of them, like, Jake does have a core of darkness that maybe is growing, like Rachel, but it's smaller. And you could argue that Jake's core gets to be smaller because Rachel's is bigger. I mean, you could argue that, definitely. Like you just said, he deploys Rachel for things that, you know, otherwise he probably would do. Because he's not going to make anyone else do them. And Cassie, obviously, is not going to have that core of darkness or dichotomy. And Tobias does have a core of darkness, but it's functional as a predatory thing. It's
yeah, he has something that he can subsume it into,
mm-hmm.
and she doesn't. And honestly, I think that's, like, kind of another theme of Rachel as a whole, but certainly also of this book, is, like, what, you know, what teenage girls are supposed to be. What they're supposed to be like, what they're supposed to be interested in, how they're supposed to look, how they're supposed to act. At the outset, when things are still kind of funny and like this could be just wacky. You know, nice Rachel goes shopping, and mean Rachel also goes shopping because she decides that she needs some leather in her life. Her wardrobe is too preppy. And meanwhile, nice Rachel's like, yeah, I do need some new clothes. Skirts. Which, you know, yes, this is humorous, but it's part of the larger theme of the book.
Well, that's something that, I mean, part of the two dichotomies, I think that there's, in a way, they're very black and white. And I think initially K.A. has cleaved Rachel into her stereotype and her subversion. Because that's what makes Rachel, like, a great character, is that she looks like a cheerleader and will also punch you in the face. And that's part of what makes her an interesting character, but I think it's also easy to glorify her in that way, because it's sort of in the same vein as, like, Buffy, for example, who you follow the pretty girl into an alley and the pretty girl kills you. And it's interesting to see the two traits play out, though, as it goes on. So, for example, Nice Rachel, and this sort of ties together with, yeah, performance of femininity and stuff like that. Like, Nice Rachel uses upspeak and is not assertive and looks to others to be able to understand, like, things around her, and is self, is sort of doubtful of herself and insecure. And also boy crazy. She also, there's a part where she just, like, talks about who's cute and who's not cute. And it's
Marco
like,
is
okay.
Cute, for the record.
I know. These are all important notes for the record. And also Marco hits on Nice Rachel at some point. These are all important notes for the record. Mean Rachel, on the other hand, is aggressive and instinctive and dresses.
It's kind of like, it's kind of like Buffy and Faith.
Yeah.
Like, the two kinds of slayers. Because, like, Buffy... Let's just do it. We're going to talk about Buffy.
It was inevitable.
You know, for up till, up through, you could argue, the entire end of the series, but certainly up through season 6, she tries really, really hard to be a human, to be a girl, to be in the world and of the world, to not just slay all the time. And when Faith appears, that's like her whole function at first, is to, like, this is what would happen if Buffy didn't have her people, if she didn't have support, if she wasn't invested in being a human and being a teenager specifically.
There's definitely Buffy comparisons to be made in Rachel's sort of archetype as that kind of teenage girl warrior. And the points about, like, living in the world and being human. I mean, in Buffy, it was an inevitability that was uncomfortable, I think, as an audience member to watch, like, confronting the reality that Buffy was always going to be separate to a certain degree and was always going to be, was never going to truly be able to be with her friends, and they confront that a lot more as the series goes on. And it's uncomfortable because, you know, as audience members, we're used to narratives where the hero's people, the found family, is what sort of keeps them human and alive. And it's very unsettling when the hero cannot live in that context and have that grounding element. And Rachel is doomed for an even bleaker fate than Buffy ever was. And I think there's Buffy comparisons as well in the book. It reminded me, just the structure of it, reminded me half of the Zeppo. Just because the plot line is going on in the background and, like there are plans happening and shit's exploding and, like, we're not really seeing it. We're getting, like, a third party as we, like, skirt alongside the action and only intersect with it at certain points. And then also in the replacement, the other Xander sort of identity, uselessness identity episode where... In that one, it's the exact same thing. Xander is split into the two
Xanders.
Extreme Xanders.
Who would have thought Xander had two extremes? Not me.
Honestly, I think that the button-down wearing Xander is not really a functional expression of, like, half of Xander's personality. Like, I don't think it works really the same way.
It's like a projection of what he wants to be.
Exactly. It's not quite the same as...
Which is fine, but it's not the same thing.
No, it's not. It is definitely not.
And there's also a little bit of, there's a little bit of Willow and Vamp Willow.
Mm-hmm. Agreed as well.
Like, the whole idea that, as Angel says in that first Vamp Willow appearance, that, you know, the vampire version of you is who you really are.
Yeah. Yeah, well, a more raw nerve without the pretenses of normalcy and who you perceive yourself to be. You're instead confronted
inhibitions.
With... Yeah, you're instead confronted with the deepest, darkest, truest self. And for Rachel, that person wants to kill everyone around her.
Yeah, and in this book, like, Mean Rachel says multiple times, like, you know, I'm Rachel. I'm the real Rachel. Like, it's me. And I don't know if Nice Rachel ever says that.
Yeah. And, well, I think there's a point as well where Nice Rachel realizes that Mean Rachel will kill her. Which is, like, heart-grippingly, like...
Also, like, what would happen if she actually did? Would both of them die?
I have no idea.
I mean, I guess not, since there's what amounts to two... They're basically twins. I mean, on a DNA level, I guess. Like, that's what happened. I mean, that's not really the point. It's not, like, the metaphor that's at work. But functionally, yeah, Nice Rachel could be killed by herself.
Yeah. Well, and metaphorically, Nice Rachel will be killed by Mean Rachel. Yep. That is the future of everything. And that's why, yeah, that's why this book is really horrible and tragic. And even things at the beginning, with the one chapter where Rachel is still whole, she says something about how she puts off a bad vibe, that people are uncomfortable around her. Yeah,
they're on, like, a field trip, and she's talking, and she's, like, with some kids at the beach, and then, you know, they don't stick around her very long because she gives off bad vibes.
Ugh.
The minor bright spot of Rachel's arc, I guess, if you wanted to look at it that way, is that the war gives her this opportunity to, like, be who she is that she wouldn't have gotten otherwise, because you just don't act like that if you're a teenage girl in America.
Uh-huh.
I guess she could have gone into the military when she was an adult, but even then, probably not her thing.
Yeah.
It's a very different kind of violence.
Well, she talks about, at the beginning, when she's still herself, she talks about how she can't really do the, like, gossip upspeak when you have, like, 1,000 times in your sentences, which is basically exactly what Nice Rachel becomes. So, you know, connecting the idea that Mean Rachel is her future, Nice Rachel is absolutely her past. And this is just, we're just checking in with Rachel on, like you said, it's sort of the tipping point in her journey where everything gets cracked out in the open. And we know now, this is very clear, that this is what's happening right now.
Do you think anybody's, like, written any academic papers about Rachel?
They should.
Yeah, they should. I mean, especially in light of things like that, where, I mean, you could read this book as just, like, a really extreme metaphor for, like, the ways in which girls hurt themselves and quash themselves and take something that some aspect of themselves that they don't perceive to be acceptable and change it into something else.
Hmm. And all of the characters in this series are well-defined and well-developed and serve their purpose in the narrative and are, like, wonderful characters that you care about and that have their own strengths and stuff like that. But Rachel really does stand out. And I think, obviously, given the ending that she got, it's clear that she was always meant to stand out in the group.
She's a little bit easier to, I don't know, to extrapolate to reality.
Uh-huh.
Like, all of them are realistic, and all of them, like, have realistic pressures and attitudes and, like, ways of viewing the world, but it's harder to take, like, the things that Jake struggles with and, like, imagine a real-world scenario for them.
Uh-huh.
Because, no, I'm never gonna have to make, like, war choices. But the things that Rachel struggles with are very realistic. Like, they're blown up, and they're given a battlefield, like, to be acted upon. But it's much easier to boil her down and be like, yeah, this is like, in an everyday scenario, this is something that happens to people. This is something people do to themselves.
Well, I think it's the way that she interacts with her environment. It's like, it's the nature versus nurture thing, that, like, there are things in your DNA that are activated when you're in certain environments. And so the nature versus nurture argument is very blurred, because you can have the quote-unquote nature for something. It could be, you know, in your genetics, but if you're never in a certain situation, like a stressful environment or something like that, then that gene isn't triggered, and it doesn't manifest or display. And with the other characters, the invasion and the war and the situation, it gives them circumstantial conflicts, and which then lead to identity issues. But really, Rachel's triggered, basically. She doesn't have the circumstantial conflict.
Like, those issues.
Yeah.
And now they're just being built upon and compounded, and she's been given this a series of scenarios that are extremely unusual in which to act them out in. Mm-hmm. Like,
and it is weird how that, weirdly enough, because she's not a normal person just affected by war. Like, usually that's always the, like, that's who your main character is in any, and who your relatable character is, like, everyday people in extraordinary circumstances. However, Rachel is not really that archetype. She's another archetype entirely, and yet she is probably the most accessible. One thing that surprised me, and that I think there is a dissent, I think you could argue against this easily, or maybe you have a really interesting, like, support for it, but I think that it is interesting that Nice Rachel, in her time of trouble, calls her dad, and then basically, up until the last moment, is highly considering telling him everything, which I think is notable. For me, it rings a little false, but I think also it's a little bit of my, like, affection for the characters. I don't think, I would like to not think, that either Rachel would put her friends in jeopardy in that way, and that's ultimately what happens in the panic of the moment.
Yeah, that bothered me too, for a couple of reasons. Mm. First of all, like, I mean, we've seen Rachel's dad, we know that, like, she misses him and her parents are divorced and whatnot, but it's never really established that she is super attached to him more than her mother. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no reason to assume that she wouldn't tell her mother.
True.
If she was going to tell someone.
True.
Second, it is established that, in this case, Nice Rachel has all the long-term planning, Mean Rachel doesn't have any. So, given that, we should have just assumed that Nice Rachel will be able to understand the ramifications of that.
Yeah.
Which is that everyone she loves would die.
Yeah.
Or be enslaved by Yerkes. It doesn't really jive, I don't think.
Okay, good.
And also, it's kind of sexist.
I agree as well. So, I'm glad that you have actual reasons, because all I knew was that, like, I made a face when I read that. I was like, I don't like that. But I'm glad that you have, like, reasons.
I did too, but I just don't like dads.
Yeah, well, I think that's part of what you were talking about, of the, like, dichotomy of like, femininity and what teenage girls are sort of expected to do, and that Nice Rachel, the idea that she would sort of engage the, like, daddy's little girl stereotype and, in a crisis situation, turn really only to her dad, and she doesn't have any sort of moments of, like, emotional vulnerability with Tobias or Cassie. And so I think it is a little bit, like, frustrating that Rachel's dad is such a non-entity throughout the series, and that he gets brought in by, like, her sort of, like, weakened quote-unquote feminine side is somebody that she's willing to risk the lives of her friends over to be able to tell the truth to, and I guess feel that sense of, like, protection, I guess. Yeah, like, I mean, it's probably done in service of that, of the dichotomy issue and the sort of femininity issue. But yeah, I think we can make some objections to that.
Yeah, I would say that was probably the weakest point of the book.
Yeah.
It's pretty transparent, like, why it happens, because there has to be some sort of kicker for Nice Rachel, like, to endanger them in order to, you know, set up a sequence of events. And as you say, it plays into, like, the Nice Rachel tropes, which are pretty and girly and says like a lot, probably loves pumpkin spice lattes if they had been invented, which they hadn't at this point in time. Weird to think about.
That is very weird.
And who is apparently, you know, is like a daddy's girl, which, again, like, calling back to the books that her father has appeared in, like, I mean, again, she misses her dad. She likes spending time with him. But she lives with her mom and her sisters, and, like, I don't know. For me, like, all this is sensible and objectionable, but the main objection for me is still that we are specifically told that she can plan into the future.
Yeah.
And that's a bad plan. It's a terrible plan.
Yeah. No, that's, so I think, the most ironclad argument. Like, independent of any, like, gender roles or, like, Rachel characterization and backstory, like, that is, yeah, that's the most ironclad argument to sort of want to strike that from the record.
Earlier you mentioned that that Nice Rachel doesn't have, like, she doesn't go to Cassie, her best friend. She doesn't go to Tobias, her bird friend. And I felt so bad for them specifically in this book. I mean, I felt bad for everybody, especially Rachel, but them too, because it's like, those of you who have best friends, hopefully all of you have a best friend. Think about what would happen if your best friend got split into two different people, and you were like, how am I supposed to deal with this? Like, I can't show any preference to Nice Rachel, and probably Cassie didn't want to, because Nice Rachel was pretty annoying. Like, she wasn't somebody that Cassie probably wanted to spend a lot of time with. Obviously, Mean Rachel wasn't either, and it's like, okay, I wouldn't blame them for, like, totally stepping back, but I also feel really bad that, like, you know, that they couldn't do anything.
Yeah, and one, it would suck that If your best friend was split in two and neither half of them held you in any real esteem. That's like...
Yeah, like, Mean Rachel would kill both of them if she had a good reason, or even not any reason at all.
Rachel did, like, she grabbed Tobias and threatened to kill him, right? Like, she had him. Yeah. Like, Jesus.
And that's not something that, like, you're gonna bounce back from.
No.
Immediately.
No.
And then, of course, Nice Rachel's, I mean, there's not enough there for her to, like, have any meaningful conversations with people, to spend time with them and, like, talk to them. Yeah, being confronted with two copies of your best friend who...
Like, the worst part.
Who are not the person that you know, neither of them is.
Yeah.
And you can't find that person that you do know in either of them. It's just like...
Yeah. And at the same time, like, I mean, obviously, I think it's a specific choice for neither Mean Rachel or Nice Rachel to go to Cassie or Tobias, or they're referenced, like, the book... starts, like, the two people who know that Rachel is not Rachel are Cassie and Tobias. Tobias has Mean Rachel, Cassie has Nice Rachel. And then at the end, when Rachel turns back, we don't really get any insight into her narrative or her narration. We don't get any insight into, like, her inner thoughts or reaction to any of this, but we get Cassie saying, "Are you okay?" And she, I don't know what she says, and then Tobias says, like, "Are you ready to go?" And then she leaves with Tobias. So that, in a way, is also interesting. Talking about Cassie, Rachel moving away from Nice Rachel and towards Mean Rachel. Cassie had Nice Rachel. Nice Rachel is more aligned with Cassie's values, but Rachel is leaving that behind. She doesn't talk to Cassie in the end. She goes with Tobias, who at least has the dichotomy element with the Predator, and who was with Mean Rachel early in the book. So it's just sort of like, oh... Her best friend and bird friend were still sort of positioned as those roles having importance, but not in a sort of tangible, meaningful way. Or the absence of meaning made meaning, I guess.
I'm going to talk about Buffy again.
Let's do it!
Here's why. At the beginning of this book, when they first realize, like, oh, this is what's happened, Mean Rachel's, like, first reaction is, this is super sweet, like, now I can kick butt full time, and you can do all the parent shit.
Mm.
Like, go to school, hang out with your mom, do whatever, be a sister, stuff, like, real kid stuff. And that's, like, isn't that basically the function of the replacement episode of Buffy? When Riley's, like, Buffy at one point is, like, I think at the end, she's, like, you know, would it be better this way? Should we split me in half? And then, like, I can be a good girlfriend, and then the rest of me can go and slay. And Riley's like, no. He's the answer there, because no, that's not what you want. That's not what he wants. It isn't what Buffy wants. Nobody wants this. They want Buffy. So, yeah, on the surface, it's like, oh, this is great. Yeah, Rachel can kick butt full time. Other Rachel can go to school and get straight A's and play the flute or whatever. But don't compartmentalize to that level.
No.
That's the moral of the story.
It really is. So yeah, I'm interested to see where things go from here, since we've talked about this book as sort of a tipping point. And I think with every podcast, because we know where things are headed, you more specifically than I do, but we have checked in on sort of the slow descent, you know, progression of all of these sort of downer things that are happening in this world. But we've referred to this book as a tipping point. We're going to stick with that, and I'm curious to see where it goes from here. And you were saying that the next book, we actually get a continuation on the anti-morphing ray as, like, a plot point.
I think so. Don't quote me on that. I'm not sure what the next book is. If it's the book that I think it is, then yes.
Number 33, The Illusion, is next. It is narrated by Tobias.
Mm.
And ghost written by Ellen Guru. The Yerks have finished their anti-morphing ray and want to test it. So yeah,
yeah,
we do continue with this one. And of course, it does bear mentioning that this last time we put a lot of emphasis on the front end that this Rachel Starfish book is the last one fully written by K.A. before the last two episodes in the series. And that is something that I did take into consideration as I was reading it, that, like, it's the most, like, pure form of canon on Rachel that there will ever be, which I think makes it also really just like, oh, like soul shattering, because you know it's coming directly from the sort of author's intent. So I think we have exhausted everything that we could possibly talk about with Rachel, her tragic identity arc, the deeply upsetting events and characteristics that come through in this novel, and how bleak it is, everything from here. So, who's ready to read more Animorphs? We're hoping that we will be able to come back to you soon with another quick turnaround. We are trying to eliminate these long hiatuses and get a good clip going through these books, especially as they get sadder and sadder and less fun in a good way. So please join us next time when we talk about number 33, The Illusion, featuring Tobias. And we hope you enjoyed all of our ramblings about Rachel and her two selves. Have a wonderful day. But I needed to grow, and I needed to know. Were there some things inside of me that I needed to show? So I just deaded you, left you in all black. But dear old Nikki, please call back.